I'm Jocelyn Sandberg. Growing up gay often brings isolation. Without support, discovering your identity can be frightening and humorous. These stories are about growing up gay in a small town in the 50s and 60s, when silence and invisibility meant deciphering all the things that were never said. They're dedicated to every gay teen who's felt alone. Good Girls Don't, by Linda Thornburg.
Rose and Lily were Judy, my first lover's great aunts. Well, Lily was her grandmother's sister, and Rose was Lily's lifelong friend. Seems they were always best friends. One day, Lily threw her no-good drunken husband out the door, and Rose moved in and stayed. Frank, or whatever his name was, never came back. That must have been about 1930. Rose and Lily lived in the same house for the next 40 years. They slept together in the same bed. Judy's grandmother was a devout, born-again Christian who preached the gospel with every breath of her life. She was as opposed to homosexuality as to the devil himself. But Lily was her sister, so she ignored it, or maybe she just didn't see it. Rose and Lily were part of every family gathering from the time before Lily evicted Frank. Everyone knew they were special friends, and wasn't it loving how Rose moved in to comfort Lily that way and take care of her when Frank was gone? No one ever said a word against them, but no one acknowledged them either. Their devotion, their anniversaries, their unnamed life together. But little Judy watched them. She knew how important they were to each other. She saw them quarrel and make up. She even saw them kiss goodnight once when she was supposed to have been asleep. They were sitting in their bed in their flannel nightgowns, kissing before turning out the light, while their great niece watched from the shadows of the hallway. In their way, they looked after Judy as she looked to them for a way she could be in the world. After she first kissed me goodnight on her bed in the junior dorm 25 years ago, and I trembled with pleasure and terror, she told me stories of Rose and Lily to keep me from bolting in abject horror of being a lesbian. Rose and Lily were angels who watched over Judy and me during a time before Stonewall, when the only mention of lesbian was as a cruel slander of a woman's humanity. Rose and Lily became our link to something we knew was deep in us that was about love, not pejoratives, that was about decency and dignity. They were our only real model of women who had chosen to love and care for each other and had somehow managed to choose themselves despite family, church, or society's objections, hostilities, or expectations. They protected us in a way when we might have given up on ourselves or someone else's acceptance. In the last decade or so, I began rethinking, reimagining the lives of people I knew growing up, unmarried teachers, family, friends, who had unseen, unspoken lives, who were more than they appeared to be. The clues lay in all the things they never said. Sometimes I discovered they were gay, sometimes not. For me, it's still a tribute to them that I suspect they were. Others definitely weren't gay. Still, in a small Midwest town in the 50s and 60s, an era that demanded conformity, the Joe McCarthy hearings on TV, followed by I Led Three Lives and Father Knows Best, they cherished and protected the children of difference. The following stories, invented from my longing to uncover the past and create a more perfect future, lovingly acknowledge a watchful band of angels. I just thought I was a good girl. You know, good girls don't. I not only didn't, I didn't want to. Neither did Doris Day, I reasoned, and if she didn't want to with Rock Hudson, surely not wanting to was okay. Of course, all the rest of the good girls did. They just pretended they didn't. as opposed to the bad girls who everyone knew did and maybe even liked the doing. The good girls, my friends, of course, came to me one by one with tearful confessions, seeking advice, someone to worry with them until their period started. Sandy went all the way with Bradley in the madrigal room. "I don't know what happened," she blubbered. I waited, hands holding hers, for the story to pour like the tears. It did in one breath. "Bradley and I were just making out in the madrigal room after practice. He said he had to. If I loved him, I would. My father will kill me. What if I'm pregnant? What about my scholarship? It hurt a lot. I'll never do it again." Swanson was getting torrid love poetry from the chemistry teacher addressed to her sultry blue eyes, begging her to meet him. What could she do? "But Swan," I screeched, "he has a wife," like it was her fault. "I know." Tears cascaded down her cheeks. "And 6 kids, what will I do?" Then she handed me a stack of love letters. Michelle, Mickey, my best friend, didn't tell me until months later. She had gone with David to a football weekend at his college. He was a sophomore. She was very sophisticated. She said they were chaperoned. She stayed at his parents' house. Of course, his parents were gone for the weekend, and they had slept in his parents' bed. It wasn't so bad, but she'd worried alone about being pregnant and the stain in the mattress pad, and what I'd think of her if I found out. I just hugged her and asked, "What stain in the mattress pad?" So why didn't I? It never even occurred to me to wonder. Someday I surely would. After I'd traveled, seen the world, conquered the American stage, then some charming, good-looking, strong, but gentle man who liked poetry would appear, and I'd both want to, and after marriage would. Besides, most boys were stupid, self-centered, and boring. They didn't know how to carry on an intelligent conversation since they normally could talk only about themselves. They had no eye for detail, no patience, were vulgar, lacked reverence for laced-winged creatures, dew-covered cherry blossoms, and probably life itself. They disdained poetry and felt only one emotion, jealousy leading to rage. It was puzzling. All the married women I knew, mostly my aunts, hated them. Their husbands drank, cheated on them, were rarely home, lacked warmth or humor, and they had married well. They would help me select a good one, they said. "Marry rich," they said, "the most ambitious one you can find. Yes, marry the one that will be President of the United States and don't settle for less." "But why can't I be president?" I asked. They shook their heads, clucked, and said, "In the end, love never really matters." They were disappointed and disillusioned. Well, I wouldn't be. They never really said anything else about the men. They were just happier when they weren't around. We all were. Then they could sit and chat and laugh like young girls, tossing their heads back, letting loose long, low laughs from the diaphragm, or doubling up into silent, heaving laughter, tears rolling down their cheeks. They seemed content doing nothing for hours, but sitting on the porch or around the kitchen table or along the seawall at the lake cottage, snapping beans or peeling potatoes or cleaning strawberries. My aunt, who was a nurse who'd met my mother's brother in London during World War II, loved the times at the lake, and she never even got in the water. She just sat on the seawall in her one-piece bathing suit, came down to dangle her feet off the end of the pier and giggle with my mother and all the other girls and lean back every once in a while and say, "Oh, Betsy, I wonder what the poor folks are doing." When the men came back, they demanded attention. "Where's my... Did you get any? Will you make me some..." All the children got quieter and tried to be invisible. The women were still obliging and cheerful, but the joy drained from their faces like the girlhood drained from their bodies. What was so damned wonderful about getting married anyway? Why spend most of a short life doing something you didn't like and being unhappy? It was a mystery of adulthood that troubled me. I doubted I'd ever understand. Maybe one day I'd untangle it. Until then, I'd stick to theater. It was far more satisfying. conversation was good. The boys seemed to experience life more fully and to have a complete range of emotions. They weren't afraid of poetry. They knew how to weep on stage. How was I to know that we were queer? I didn't even know there was such a thing, let alone that I was one. I was just a good girl, maybe the only helpful convention of the entire era. I didn't even know the word lesbian until I was one. Well, maybe I always was one, but I didn't know the word until I was a senior in high school. It wasn't that I heard bad things about queers, or that my family spoke ill of homosexuals, or that I heard the stereotypes. I heard absolutely nothing. I didn't know there were people who loved members of the same sex. I hadn't heard the word homosexual, or lesbian, or even faggot. I'd heard the word queer. One didn't wear green on Thursday because it was queer. But I just thought it meant odd. And teenagers don't like being odd. A queer was a nerd, as far as I knew. Then one day at rehearsal, I heard Terry McBride telling Ron Souther, Phil's younger brother, she is a thespian, you know. He put such wicked intentionality in the tone, such a lisp on the S, that I knew it was evil. But what did it mean? Weren't we thespians? Then what did he mean about Miss Hamilton, the history teacher? I had to ask my best friend, Mickey, after school. She said, they mean the word that starts with L that sounds like thespian, and raised her eyebrows and shook her head like I was going to get it. What? I said. She leaned in close and whispered, lesbian. I wasn't sure I heard. Lesbian? I repeated, twice the decibels. Shh, she commanded, not so loud. Well, what does it mean? I whispered. She looked at me in astonishment, as she often did, as if I were so completely unsophisticated she couldn't believe that we were best friends. I'd never even been to the opera or the symphony. I was already 17. Not to mention that I'd dropped Latin after the 9th grade to take that insipidly easy French. At least I could have taken German, the language of Wagner and Goethe, which she dare not hear me pronounce. The shock drained from her face, replaced with pity and social service concern. She should at least educate me. It's a woman who likes other women. Now I was completely confused. Why was she shushing me over a word that just meant a woman who likes other women? Wasn't that us? No, not likes. Likes. You know. Again the raised eyebrows. Does it with other women? I still wasn't sure, but I was getting closer. Does it? You mean like has sex with? Yes. Well, they said Nora Hamilton was a thespian. She probably is. From then on, I was fascinated by Miss Hamilton. I studied her. Mickey and I obsessed about her private life. We watched her every gesture to see if there were some clue. We hung on her every word. We reconnoitered several times a day between classes to share our latest scrap of information, making it into evidence. Then something quite bizarre began to happen. Every time we met to whisper about her, she'd show up. First it seemed a funny coincidence. Then it became further proof, a sign, that we had discovered some truth about her and she had to watch us. It didn't matter where we were. Ground floor lockers, second floor library, girls' room behind the auditorium, even tucked away in the madrigal room behind the choral director's office, the most private of private spaces. Wherever and whenever we continued our secretive whisperings about Miss Hamilton, she appeared. We would blush, check ourselves, and hope we hadn't spoken her name loudly enough for her to hear. We began to talk about her in code, so when she showed up, she wouldn't overhear her name. It was uncanny enough to become frightening. We imagined she was stalking us. It reached a state of terror when I was selected as the first girl from White River High to go to the Purdue Legislative Assembly. The Purdue Legislative Assembly was a mock congressional assembly held annually for high school government students at Purdue University. It was a big honor. Normally, only boys were selected. But I had done so well in Nora's American history class that the committee had selected me to go to the two-day assembly. Nora was on the selection committee, and she'd fought for me to go. Everyone was really excited for me. Mickey and I had an emergency locker conference. I was to go to Purdue with three boys from White River High. That presented a problem. All the boys stayed together in a dorm room, but since I was a girl, I couldn't stay with them in the dorm. The housing problem was one of the main reasons White River High had never taken girls before. That, and the fact that the faculty sponsor, Mr. Harris, the civics teacher, the one who drove the boys to Purdue, didn't want girls to ride in the same car. No doubt a girl would seduce them all in a car on the way. Nora, outraged by the inability of Mr. Harris and the male faculty to solve a simple, no, non-existent problem, offered the solution. She would drive, too. She would chaperone me. I wouldn't leave her sight except to go to the assembly meetings. She'd get a hotel room in the Purdue Union, and she and I would share it. That way, Mr. Harris wouldn't have to worry about me seducing or distracting his poor, vulnerable boys. Now, all I had to worry about was Miss Hamilton. Mickey and I huddled. Should I go or not? I had to go. It was an honor. Besides, Mickey would coach me through a list of things to watch out for, things which might excite Nora and cause her to... what, we weren't sure. She made a list. 1, check the hotel room. If there's a double bed, ask for a different room. 2, do not dress or undress in front of her. 3, beware of innocent-seeming language or acts like, would you help me with my zipper? Carefully coached, I would do all right. I prepared a bill for introduction in the Legislative House. It was on the Panama Canal Zone. I wrote a bill to give the zone back to Panama. I'd done all the research at the White River College Library, carefully studied the language of House bills. Whereas I was so busy preparing the bill and a speech supporting it, I didn't have time to worry about Miss Hamilton's potential advances. When it was mostly written, she helped me with the language and coached me with the speech. The time came. We left on Friday from school and drove to West Lafayette. We chatted amicably in the car. She wasn't at all intimidating sitting in the car, the front seat pulled close to the dash to accommodate her short legs. She rolled down the window to smoke once or twice. She'd brought some gum and candy bars. Somehow the conversation came around to boyfriends. I told her I was going steady with Tucker Carson. She was startled. But you don't seem the type to be interested in going steady. And then she added, you don't wear his ring. All the girls wore their boyfriends' class rings carefully and ostentatiously wrapped with yards of angora on their wedding fingers. I didn't. I was shocked she'd noticed. I said it was true. I wasn't very interested in going steady, but he'd wanted to, so I did since I wasn't interested in dating anyone else. I didn't say I dated Tucker because I thought he was the only boy in class who could possibly become president of the United States. But I did explain that I wore his ring, only looped it through a bracelet and dangled it from my wrist like another charm. I held it up. I don't like being identified, I said, by somebody's class ring wrapped in ridiculous angora as if I were his possession. And it's a dreadful waste of time to wrap and unwrap the ring daily in angora to match your outfit. So I don't wear the ring in any visible manner. Probably lots of people don't know we're going steady. It was his idea, not mine. And my concession is the bracelet. Tucker is very possessive. We fought about the ring, but I convinced him that this is unique and holds us apart from the crowd. He likes that. She smiled, as if she possessed some secret knowledge about my future. I wondered what the smile meant, but the conversation shifted to what I wanted to study in college and where I was going to school. Both of us were more comfortable. We got to Purdue in time for dinner. She checked us into the hotel, and I wondered how I was going to know what the sleeping situation was before she checked in, and how I could possibly object to a room after she'd checked in. Mickey's plan was flawed. She had said, check the pillows. Tell her you're allergic to feathers. What if they're foam rubber? What if all the pillows in the hotel are foam rubber? Then start sneezing and tell her you're allergic to something and need another room and sneeze until you get the one with single beds. At the desk, I shifted my weight nervously. How could I possibly fake sneezing, brilliant an actress as I was? My heart raced in the elevator. Maybe I would just have a heart attack and be taken to the hospital. She unlocked the door to the room and went inside. I followed, barely breathing. There, in the room, were single beds set on perpendicular walls. They weren't even opposite each other like on Father Knows Best. One hurdle jumped. We had a pleasant dinner. She told me I could have whatever I liked and suggested the veal. I didn't know what veal was, so I had a fillet. I felt quite grown up. There was an evening meeting of the legislators, so we could caucus, build strategies for the sessions on Saturday. The adult leader asked how many people had written bills. A few of us raised our hands, maybe a dozen out of 535 students gathered. I was the only one from White River who'd written a bill. None of the boys had. It wasn't such a big deal for them to go to Purdue. They were boys, after all, and didn't have anything to prove. I was instantly set upon by a number of young men hovering around to offer support. One eager lad from Indianapolis offered to present my bill for me. I said I didn't think that would be appropriate since I'd written it and I had a speech already. He said I could concentrate on the speech better if I let him introduce the bill, that I wouldn't have to be so concerned with so many details, that the presentation was simple, but the speech counted. After 20 minutes of arguing, I finally conceded. Back in the room, Nora offered me the bathroom first to get ready for bed. I took my zippered plastic toiletries case, pajamas, and bathrobe, and emerged completely covered. Then she took her turn. She didn't even wait to see me take off my bathrobe and hop in bed. She came out in a respectable nightgown and robe, got in bed, and turned out the light. She wished me luck in the morning. In the session, the boy from Indianapolis introduced the bill, and I gave a speech supporting it. Nora Hamilton rushed up to me at lunch nearly in tears. Why had I let that boy introduce my bill? I told her what had happened. "It's all my fault," she said. "I never dreamed someone would do that. I never dreamed I'd have to say, 'Be sure to present the bill.' Since you'd written it, I presumed you would. How would I know someone would steal it from you? I'm so sorry I didn't know better so I could coach you better." She was in such distress. I tried to comfort her. "I'd given a great speech," I said, "and after all, I had drafted the bill, and that must count for something." Tucker was angry I'd let someone besides him present it. I had no idea what the fuss was about until the legislative assembly was over, and the boy from Indianapolis was named one of the top 10 legislators from the session for presenting my bill, and I wasn't named at all. Nora was bereft. She dragged Mr. Harris to the advisory committee, all men, who said it was all part of the learning process. Next time, I'd know better. Of course, there wouldn't be a next time. She apologized again. I had done such good work, drafted a bill, the only one to pass the assembly, and this boy had gotten all the credit and won some sort of scholarship. She couldn't stop apologizing for failing me. I was angry and confused, but I had to let it go. I was embarrassed by my failure, my naivete. I was embarrassed more by my reckless misjudgment of Miss Hamilton. She had not only been the perfect chaperone, she had tried to protect me from the evils of a world I didn't have language for yet. She'd been an ally, not a seductress. She had battled for me to go, coached me separately from the boys. I had done well. I had written a bill and would have walked away in the top 10 if I hadn't been conned by the boy from Indianapolis who cheated and won. He's probably in politics today. And she felt personally responsible for my innocence. How could I have misjudged her so, whispered so surreptitiously of her evil intent? All I wanted to do was hide my shame over my suspicions. Of course, they probably were true. Miss Hamilton probably was a lesbian. I'm grateful she was. Who else would have cared so profoundly, taken so personally the success of a naive high school girl? Not Mr. Harris, certainly. Who else would have battled so fiercely the thievery of the young man from Indianapolis? only a woman who knew what it was like to be an independent woman in a man's world. Only someone who could see my future and try to prepare me for it. How fortunate that she was there, as visible as she was in 1964. I wish I'd won that spot on the top 10 for her. We were friends after that. Mickey and I had a new respect for her and stopped whispering in the hallway. I'd often stop by to see Nora after school, until I got so busy with the senior class play that I had no time for anything else. When I went back to White River years later, I looked her up. I had come out in the meantime. I couldn't tell her. I still didn't say thanks, but I went by to see her. She seemed pleased. She was still tough with a throaty laugh. Her eyes danced with mischief. But she was dying of cancer. My visit was brief. The next time I went home, she was gone. I was filled with regret. I wanted to say thank you. Thank you, Miss Hamilton, for being the first woman I ever suspected was a lesbian. You were a woman of strength, integrity, and compassion, a wonderful mentor, a sturdy, silent sentinel standing watch over my rite of passage. In the summer after our first year in college, Mickey told me that there used to be a lesbian bar in White River. Not in White River, I protested. Yes, it was at the end of North Meridian, where it turns west just before the river by the hardware store to cut over the Jefferson Bridge. I got the Corvair. Mickey didn't drive. We drove by. It was there, between the railroad and the river. She pointed to an old abandoned building. How do you know? I asked. Nora and my mother, before she married Thomas. Thomas wasn't Mickey's dad or even stepdad, but her mother's second husband, so she called him by his first name. And Miss L and Miss C and several other women teachers used to hang out there, she said. My jaw dropped. My mother stopped going there when she married Thomas, she said again with emphasis. But she told me. No wonder she knew Nora was a thespian. I like to think of Nora there, in that small-town bar, defiant on weekends, flirting, radiant in her navy scoop-neck sweater and matching skirt, her characteristic string of pearls resting above her considerable cleavage, her lips painted red, hands on her hips, head thrown back in her throaty laugh. She must have drunk scotch, danced wildly, and kissed some pretty women. In 1970, terrified that my lover of 2 years was really a lesbian, I ran as far away as possible. I moved from Boston to Japan.
For the balance of this program, please turn the cassette over now.